You know, most Americans today are frankly among the richest people in the history of the world. Even those who might be considered almost impoverished by the standards of our culture, most Americans, not necessarily all, but certainly most, have food in their refrigerators. They have beds to sleep in. They drive cars. They talk on cell phones. They watch TVs. They wear Nike sneakers. By international and historic standards, that makes us extremely wealthy. Yet in spite of our material prosperity, or maybe because of it, our American culture suffers from poverty of a different sort. You know, we really suffer from a poverty of soul. And the taste of pleasure has grown our appetite for this world beyond its ability to satisfy. And meanwhile, the desperate search for meaning in life continues. All of these possessions, all of these opportunities, all of these seemingly good and pleasurable things, notwithstanding. It's been a couple weeks, but tonight we're resuming our study in Ecclesiastes, a series I've entitled Making Sense Out of Life. And the opening section of chapter 2 really talks about what we've just been thinking about there, the pursuit of pleasure. Now, in our first two sessions, we worked our way through chapter 1, where Solomon, who we talked about, refers to himself as the preacher in this book of Ecclesiastes, as the one who stands and instructs the assembly. And the preacher repeatedly says things like this: vanity of vanities, all is vanity. You know, attempts at earthly success are vanity. The unpredictability of the events of life, vanity. Trying to take control of your life, that's vanity. Even the use of God-given wisdom to try to make sense out of it sometimes is vanity. In a broad sense, all of earthly life, the entirety of life under the sun, as Solomon describes it, is vanity. It's empty. Now, just kind of by way of review, you may remember that the Hebrew word that is translated vanity, or in some translations they'll have meaningless, is the Hebrew word hebel. And it's really the same as the name of Adam and Eve's son, Abel. Okay, and it's a word that means actually vapor, or mist, or breath, or wind. And so every time we encounter that word in Ecclesiastes, it's helpful for us to think of it that way. And you'll say, Pastor, you've said this a bunch of times, and I'll keep saying it, because it really is, if we're to understand this book properly, that becomes critical. The vexation of spirit, which means the idea of chasing after the wind, that's critical. The idea of the implications of the word prophet, there are just some different expressions that Solomon refers to and uses again and again and again that really tie this book together. So that's why I just bring these things up, to make sure that we are straight about the meaning of these particular terms that have special significance in this book. And in the opening chapter of Ecclesiastes, Solomon explained how he applied his considerable intellect and the wisdom that God gave him in answer to prayer in order to try to make sense out of life. And his initial conclusion, just kind of in that introductory chapter, is that the meaning of life is elusive. And true satisfaction from life under the sun is hard to come by. Things that seem like they should bring satisfaction really don't. And the unfolding events of life, it seems like there should be kind of some pattern and some predictability of the air there, yet there really isn't. Things happen like what happened to Job. How do we explain those things? Life just sometimes seems unfair. And his bottom line is that it's just hard to wrap your mind around it all. And it seems like there should be an explanation. It seems like there should be something more. But so far, at least in his description for us, it's not there. Life is vanity. It's hebel. And trying to figure life out, well, that's like trying to shepherd the wind. Making sense out of the way life on this earth works is a lot like herding cats, if we want to use our contemporary idiom that has the same idea as that idea of vexation of spirit and chasing the wind. So that brings us to chapter 2. And at this point, it may be that a lesser man than Solomon would perhaps have just kind of given up on his quest and said, what's the point? You can't figure it out anyway. I mean, I'm the wisest guy that's ever been, at least humanly speaking, and I can't sort this thing out. It just doesn't seem to make sense. You know, and maybe he just slumps into his chair and has this feeling of depression and futility over it all, but that's not what Solomon does. He's intent on digging into this and on working through this so that he can stand up, so to speak, and instruct us and help us come to grips with what really life is about, what's important, what's significant, what satisfies. So he continues now in his discussion to describe how he sought out those things in life that bring satisfaction. Ecclesiastes chapter 2 and verse 1, he begins with these words, I said, and the idea is, I said to myself, I said in mine heart. So Solomon begins by talking to himself here. You ever do that? You know, kind of debate things within your mind, talk through how you're going to approach something. That's what he's doing here. And he moves on to conduct two experiments, we might say, two tests, two trials. He's going to evaluate two specific human endeavors under the sun to see if they lead to satisfaction in life. So in verses 1 through 11, that's our text for tonight, we have Solomon's investigation into man's search for joy and happiness, his pursuit of pleasure. And then in verses 12 through 17, Solomon examines the benefits that wisdom affords to see if that's the answer to making life better and more fulfilling, to leveraging life for our advantage, as we could say. So we'll look at that section next week. But for tonight here, take a look. Let's read through verses 1 through 11. And just kind of think about what he's saying here as we go through this. I said in mine heart, go to now. In other words, he says, okay, let's do this. I will prove these, talking to himself, I will test you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure, and behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of mirth, what doeth it? I saw it in mine heart to give myself unto wine, yet acquainting mine heart with wisdom, and to lay hold on folly till I might see what was the good for the sons of men, which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. I made me great works. I builded me houses. I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruits. I made me pools of water to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. I got me servants and maidens and had servants born in my house. Also I had great possessions of great and small cattle above all that were in Jerusalem before me. I gathered me also silver and gold and the peculiar treasures of kings and of the provinces. I get me men singers and women singers, and the delights of the sons of men, as musical instruments and that of all sorts. So I was great, and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy. For my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my portion. This is what resulted from all my labor. Verse 11, then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. Entitled tonight's message, The Pursuit of Pleasure. Pursuit of pleasure. Father, we are thankful for this passage that really is so, so relevant to the world in which we live. So relevant to our lives as American Christians. So relevant to the lives of any believer. Because we have within us this flesh that just craves pleasure. Happiness, satisfaction. We have this flesh that is so enticed and allured by the pleasures of the world around us. And yet, Father, as Solomon learned, as many of us have found through our own experiences, as all of us will find as we pursue pleasure, these things do not satisfy. I pray that you would use your word tonight, and I think there will be no conclusions that we will draw here that we haven't already thought about, that are not very, very evident to us as believing people. And yet there is still that contest within our soul. The flesh lusting after the world and its pleasures. And the spirit desiring a close walk with God. I pray, Father, that you would use your word tonight as your spirit ministers it to our hearts. To steer us in the right direction. To help us make the wise choice. To help us better understand what it is that does indeed satisfy, what really makes a difference. So we ask your blessing now on our time together in your word. In Jesus' name I pray, amen. So as Solomon begins talking to himself, it's not about something life-changing like the beauty of God or the good news of his grace. Rather, he's thinking about how to get more out of life. Maybe something he's missed up until now. And there's a sense in which we can look at this and think that Solomon is taking a really secular approach and this isn't a very wise thing. And there's probably something to that because Solomon is a fleshly man, as we know from reading about his life. You know, he has his highs, he has his lows. But really, Solomon sets forth on this with the idea of I want to see what life has to experience. You know, what is it that really brings satisfaction? What is it that really brings joy? So it's not an experiment I would suggest we undertake, but it is one that Solomon undertakes for us and wants us to learn from it. And so, it's as if he's kind of saying, you know, what I've thought about so far, there's got to be more to life than this. That can't be all that there is. And so he says to himself, this is verse 1, go to now. He says, okay, here's what we're going to do. I will prove thee with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure. In other words, he says to himself, you know, just go out and enjoy yourself. Take advantage of the things that you have. Take advantage of the opportunities that are around you. I mean, take advantage of the world that God has planted you in. Go out and enjoy yourself. The word prove or test indicates that what is to follow is kind of an experiment, a deliberate attempt to learn something through personal experience. And the word mirth refers to the pleasures of life. It's just whatever makes you happy. You know, it's not necessarily frivolity. Sometimes we think about mirth as that, but it's really the idea of that which to you brings joy, that which to you brings happiness, that which to you brings pleasure. And he says, go out and pursue those things. Just enjoy what life has to offer. Surely there's satisfaction in that. And so Solomon answers himself, okay, all right, I'll give it a try. Let's see what life has to offer in all its pleasures. And what Solomon describes is what life is like for anyone who freely indulges himself in the pursuit of self-centered pleasure. And I don't know if you picked up on this as we were reading those verses, but just sometime go through. I didn't even bother to count them up. There were just too many. I got worn out on counting. How many he says, I, my, mine, me. I mean, it's there in every verse. He's just, you know, it's this idea of, so I am going to find out what you know, wets my whistle, what trips my trigger, what makes me happy. That's what I'm going to do. And that's going to be different things for different people, but Solomon tried out a number of them, and they are the kinds of things that the human psyche tends to kind of want to go after and somehow or other has this idea that, you know, if I only had that, if I could only do that, if I was only involved in that, surely that would be fulfilling, that would be satisfying, that would be an exciting addition to my life. It would really make a difference. And so Solomon sets out to make his own personal happiness his chief end in life. And I want to suggest to us, folks, that in our world, that is the way that much of the world lives today. You know, and that doesn't mean that they don't do generous, whatever it is. You know, for some people, being a giver of good things to others is satisfying to them. You know, sometimes people even talk about spiritual gifts as being rooted about what brings you satisfaction, which I've always thought is backwards. Spiritual gifts are supposed to be, how can God use me to be a blessing to others? Not how can God use me so that I can be satisfied in my ministry? You know, and sometimes you see that even people in the pursuit of ministry, it's more about their satisfaction and how fulfilling this is to me than realizing that ministry is about me serving other people. So the pursuit of pleasure isn't always the things that we categorize as, you know, hyper-indulgent. It's whatever brings joy to you. You know, and if that is your motivation, then you're following right through this experiment, just like Solomon. Now, immediately, as he begins talking about this, Solomon tells us that this quest failed as spectacularly as the one that he pursued in chapter 1. At the end of verse 1, he says, behold, and you see that word behold periodically in Ecclesiastes. In fact, it's at least twice in our text here. And it's kind of like, it's kind of an emphatic expression saying, and, you know, eureka, look at this. Here's what I found. Behold, look at it. This also is vanity. You know, the other things that I had examined were vanity. Now as I pursue pleasure, I found out that, you know, even just trying to live for my own happiness, that too is vanity. Now, he's not prejudging his experiment here. You know, rather, he's just telling us right up front, you know, here's how it all turned out. And it wasn't the way that he necessarily thought it might. And frankly, that's the answer that even the world comes to, whether they'll admit it or not. The pursuit of pleasure doesn't satisfy. That's why the rate of suicide, you know, amongst the Hollywood elite is higher than the rate of suicide for the world at large. They have everything, and they've come to the conclusion that, you know what? I got everything. What more is there? And I'm still not happy. And I'm still not satisfied. You know, we live on the side of thinking, if I only had this, they've got it. And then they found out that, you know what? Having it didn't do it. That's what Solomon says. I found out that this also was vanity. The pursuit of pleasure doesn't satisfy. Ultimately, it's just more vanity, more vapor. Then in verses 2 through 8, Solomon chronicles the various pleasures that he tried. And I won't elaborate on all of these, but I'll try to highlight some of them because I think we'll see that they're very common. They're the kinds of things maybe we struggle with. They're certainly the kinds of things that we see in the world. And I'll divide the pleasurable pursuits that Solomon describes into two categories, the good times and the good life. So let's talk about Solomon, you know, letting the good times roll, as the world says. First, he experimented with comedy, for lack of a better term. You know, a form of entertainment that many people use to make it through life. When they feel insecure, they make a joke about something. When they get down on themselves, they make fun of someone else. When they're bored, they look for something to grab their attention and make them laugh. Anything to get their minds off of the serious, seemingly mundane realities of life. You know, this is what the long-running, off-color show Saturday Night Live is all about, and many others like it. In fact, most of primetime TV in this day and age has gravitated towards many, many off-color, strange comedic things, this mindless comedy. Well, the preacher tried this sort of thing, yet it failed to bring him any lasting fulfillment. You know, look at his conclusion, verse 2. I said of laughter it is mad, and of mirth, of pleasure, what doeth it? The word mad isn't talking about being crazy or out of your mind. It's not talking about a mental state. One commentator wrote this. Solomon is talking about moral perversity rather than mental oddity. You know, and a lot of laughter is like that. It is morally perverse. Not all of it, of course. There is joyful, moral, encouraging laughter, things that are uplifting, that aren't necessarily a problem, things that ultimately are honorable to God, and healthy laughter at wholesome things, that brings glory to God. But a lot of joking is shallow and superficial and cynical and sarcastic and oftentimes even cruel. You know, and you don't have to sit on even Facebook very long to see the political barbs that are out there from both parties to the other side. You know, and the funny things, and you know, people will even sometimes put their comment on it. I know I shouldn't laugh at this because it's kind of twisted, but I can't help myself. You know, and there's a certain thought that this kind of distracting, twisted up, strange humor is somehow or other beneficial. Solomon says, no, it's not. You know, if we are to honor God, we need to ask whether our laughter is rejoicing in the goodness of God and good things from God, or is it coming at someone else's expense? The preacher discovered that when it comes to understanding the meaning of our existence, laughter turns out to be a useless pleasure. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of mirth, of pleasure, what doeth it? In other words, when he says what doeth it, he means what's the point? What's the purpose? What does all this sarcastic, mindless humor accomplish anyway? Yeah, how does that make life more meaningful and fulfilling? And one of the things we're going to see here that comes up periodically in Ecclesiastes, you know, is the emphasis on taking a sober look at life. That's that passage I've referenced before that I'll often use at funerals. You know, it's better to go to the house of mourning than the house of feasting. It's not saying it's bad to go enjoy a feast, a nice banquet meal. That's not the problem. But it's just that there are things to be learned from a serious evaluation of life and what's going on that can't be learned any other way. And folks, life is no laughing matter. You know, some people laugh their way to the grave, but there's nothing funny about someone who ignores Christ their whole life and dies without him. The next thing Solomon tried was alcohol, another of the world's popular ways to presumably find enjoyment in life or perhaps to escape from its troubles. One writer referred to alcohol as a lubricant for the laughter. Verse 3 says, I sought in mine heart to give myself unto wine, yet acquainting mine heart with wisdom, and to lay hold on folly till I might see what was that good for the sons of men, which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. Now, this is a hard verse to really sort out, and we won't go through all the nuances. You know, it's hard to know whether Solomon was referring to the idea of becoming a carouser and a drunkard. I mean, that's possible. He makes reference to foolishness, and certainly when we think about alcohol and alcoholism, that kind of comes to mind. But I got to say, Solomon says this in Proverbs 20 and verse 1. He says, wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging, and whosoever is deceived thereby is not wise. You know, and here in verse 3, he talks about, I retained my wisdom. He says, I pursued wine, but I retained my wisdom. So I'm thinking, and this is what some commentators would suggest, that Solomon isn't so much saying, go out and get drunk, as he is saying, enjoy the pleasures, the refined culture of let's say, what we would refer to maybe as wine tasting. You know, and they would say that what Solomon is talking about here is the use of wine for sophistication, you know, rather than inebriation. And I will confess to you a personal experience along those lines. You know, I grew up in just a little town, you know, not high culture, just, you know, ordinary, regular folks. You know, the, what do they call them? The salt of the earth kind of people, right? That's where I grew up. You know, just regular people, you know, without all the exposure to all the highfalutin stuff. Travel wasn't like it was now. There was no internet, you know, so you lived in your little town and you knew those kinds of things. So I go off to college and I am introduced to the proper idea of wine tasting. That if you go to a high-class restaurant and you order a bottle of wine that's more than $2, you know, they bring out the bottle, the waiter takes out the cork, you smell the cork, you give him the nod, you know, he pours a little bit in a glass, you know, you waft in the aroma, the bouquet, you swirl it around a little bit and look at it, you sip it a little bit, swirl it around in your mouth and give him an okay, and then they pour glasses of wine for everybody at the table, you know, and that's what sophisticates do. And there was a time that I took my parents out for dinner just shortly after finishing college, ordered a bottle of wine, and did that, and my dad had never seen that before and was kind of taken in by it. I didn't realize that until years later. You know, my wife and I began to be discipled, and we repudiated alcohol in all its sorts. And I remember my dad saying, you know, what happened to you? And then he recounted that time, you know, of what, how amazed he was and impressed by my wine tasting ability, and now I won't even touch this stuff. And you know, what happened? How does this fit? And I think Solomon is talking maybe a little bit about the sophistication of, you know, that side of alcohol. Obviously, we live in a world that's all about the other side of alcohol, and maybe that's what Solomon's talking about too. I don't know, but you know, there are people that just really think that alcohol's the answer. How can you enjoy a meal without alcohol? How can you enjoy life without alcohol? When I was a kid, the Schlitz Beer Company had a commercial, and it went like this: "You only go around once in life. So you got to grab for all the gusto that you can get." And the answer to grabbing for the gusto was their particular brand of beer. And the implication was, you know, if you want to live an exciting life, if you want to live a life of gusto and satisfaction, you need our beer. Because water just won't cut it. Even Diet Mountain Dew won't cut it. You need our beer, okay? You know, but that is the world's view. That is the world's view. And those of you, some of you work in the world, and you have to go to conventions, and you have a certain amount of working dinners and things like that. And you will know that you are, and I trust you are, consistently declining on the glass of wine, declining on the drink, declining on the mug of beer. But we live in a world that thinks that, you know, that's just, how can you socialize without it? How can you eat a meal without it? How can you enjoy life without it? Solomon says, it is not the answer. It does not measure up. Life is short, Solomon says at the end of verse 3. Can you really enjoy life without pursuing the good times that the world holds so dear? Solomon says, yeah, you can. Those things, they don't satisfy. It's nothing but vanity. Then Solomon talks about his pursuit of the good life. You know, there's the good things of life and the good life. In addition to wine and laughter, there are many other pleasures in life, and Solomon was rich enough to try almost all of them. He lived the lifestyle of the rich and famous, building beautiful mansions and planting magnificent gardens. Look at verse 4. He says, I made me great works. I builded me houses. I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens and orchards. Here's all the I's and me's, right? I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruits. I made me pools of water to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. So, you know, God had blessed Solomon with wisdom and with creativity. And Solomon used his considerable abilities to make and develop his estate. I mean, the man was apparently an architect and a builder and a landscaper. 1 Kings 7 tells us that he spent more than a decade and unimaginable monies building his palace. And this talks about houses, so apparently he built some other things as well. And he was skilled in viticulture. He was, planted expansive vineyards to make that wine for his royal banquet halls. And he planted flowers, beautiful flowers, to adorn the tables. And he planted trees from which to get wood, and also so you can just take that relaxing walk through the woods, taking in the aromas of the flowers, viewing the beauty of those things. He describes lush landscaping surrounding peaceful ponds and expansive pools. He had reservoirs of such a size as to be able to irrigate a forest from which he harvested wood for his enterprises. You know, and all these things were on a scale that we can scarce imagine. Solomon himself describes them in verse 4 as great works. I did all these great works. Look at verses 7 and 8. He says, I got me servants and maidens, and had servants born in my house. Also I had great possessions of great and small cattle above all that were in Jerusalem before me. I gathered me also silver and gold and the peculiar treasure of kings and of the provinces. And of course, if you read through the book of 1 Kings and you find out about Solomon's kingship, and people came from all around the world to just lavish him with gifts, with the finery of their culture, of their part of the world. And he had unimaginable wealth, unimaginable honor before them, just all the privileges, all of the blessings. You know, he not only had mansions, but he had money. He was, and this is the understatement of the night, pleasurably and enjoyably wealthy to the extreme. And given the scope of his building projects and the extent of his property, he needed a huge workforce to maintain his estate. So he had all these servants, and they're giving birth to servants in his home, and those then become his, and there's just, you know, this absolutely vast array of servants, people to tend to the house, people to prepare the meals, people to clean, people to tend to the gardens, all of those things, all these servants, everybody at his beck and call. He used some of his riches to make beautiful music. The end of verse 8, he says, I got me men singers and women singers and the delights of the sons of men, his musical instruments and that of all sorts. Music was a rare pleasure in those days, but the preacher could afford to bring it into his own home, engaging entire choirs to sing for his pleasure at his beck and call. Now, we understand in our day the desirability of music to the human soul. You know, now, there's music out there that calms the soul, that nourishes the soul. There's music out there that disrupts and contaminates the soul. But nonetheless, there is this view that music is just such an amazing thing. And Solomon had the best of music that could be available in his day. The best in every way. He had everything. Whatever money could buy, whatever he wanted, whatever he put his mind to, he could do it. Whatever he desired to have, he could have it. And that reference, the end of verse 8 there is a little convoluted in word order, but the reference to the delights of the sons of men, most commentators believe that's a reference to Solomon's harem of beautiful women and the sensual delights of men. In 1 Kings 11 and verse 3, you know, we have the statistics. We're told that Solomon had 700 wives and princesses, along with 300 concubines. You know, he had more sexual partners than anyone could imagine. You know, the most notorious ladies' men in Hollywood today don't even come close to the sensual conquests of King Solomon, the great King Solomon. So, you know, wine, women, and song. Solomon had all those things and more. If Solomon lived today, you'd find him on the cover of Time magazine. You know, he'd be Man of the Year. He'd be in People magazine pretty much every issue. He'd be on Forbes for his wealth. He'd probably be pictured on the Architectural Digest for the beauty of his living place. You know, truly, Solomon grabbed for all the gusto. At least all the gusto as the world would see it. And he got it. Yet, here's his summary of his pleasurable pursuits, verses 9 through 11. He says, so I was great. And that may sound arrogant, but that's really not his point. He's saying, you know, I was kind of at the pinnacle of the world, the pinnacle of society. You know, I had everything. I was great in that sense. Increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. And the idea there is pretty much the most, I don't know, extravagant kingdom ever. You know, and there's nothing that would compare to it. Also, my wisdom remained with me. And you know, we remember how people would come just to ask Solomon probing questions and marvel at his insight, at his discernment, at his wisdom. And so that also tells us that as he's doing these things, he's doing it not having cast aside his wisdom, but thinking these things through and the implications of them. And verse 10, and whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. So I pursued pleasure to the fullest degree. Whatever it was, I took it. I withheld not my heart from any joy, any pleasure. for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was the portion of all my labor. So he worked at these things to just create this whole environment around him. And now he's reaping the benefits of it. And that is a mindset that's very much in our world. In fact, you know, the idea is, you know, you work hard, you get the desserts. You get the blessings from it. Now you get to go into retirement and enjoy, you know, what you've worked your life to accomplish. That's the kind of thing Solomon's talking about. This idea of we work with the interest of spending it then on our pleasure. Verse 11, then I looked. And the word there is the idea of I considered. I evaluated. I thought all this through with the wisdom that God gave me. I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought and on the labor that I had labored to do. And again, behold, and then get this, still, it was all vanity, empty, like a vapor. And it was vexation of spirit. It was just like, you know, trying to wrap your arms around the wind, and there was no profit, no advantage to it, no real benefit, seeming benefit maybe, but no real benefit, no lasting benefit, no genuine fulfillment under the sun. It just didn't satisfy. Maybe for a time, but nothing lasting. I think most of us are familiar with the verse in Hebrews 11 that gives us the commentary about Moses, how he chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. And one of our missionaries, I'm thinking maybe it was Brother Phil, but I'm not sure, you know, just commented on that idea of for a season. It's just that idea of their temporary pleasures, their short-lived pleasures. And those things that in the world's context seem so desirable, seem to be so exciting, so alluring, so beneficial. They are all of them, temporary pleasures, short-lived pleasures. They may seem good for a while, but not for long. And as we talked about, that's why you see so many people who seem to have all the privileges, all the blessings, all the resources, all the possessions are so often unhappy, unfulfilled people, because those pleasures may have satisfied them for a little while, but then they're looking for something more. And they reach the point that says, I've bought everything my money can buy, everything that there is, and it's still not enough. Pleasure doesn't last. Not laughter, not money, not possessions, not music, not sexual encounters. Those pleasures bring no real fulfillment. It's just vanity. There is no profit under the sun. Pleasure pursued for its own sake does not and cannot satisfy the soul. And folks, we need to learn that lesson. Young people, you need to learn that lesson. You know, one of the provinces of kind of moving from childhood into young adulthood is this sense of, you know, I need to try out some things for myself. My parents may say, this is not a good thing. My teachers may say, this is not a good thing. My pastor may say, this is not a good thing. But, you know, I want to experience it for myself. And they think that these pleasures will satisfy. Young people, you will find that they will not. They may seem to for a little while, but it's a fleeting satisfaction. And ultimately, it's soul deadening rather than soul uplifting. When I was a kid, pretty young kid, there was a song out in the popular airwaves entitled, Is That All There Is? Okay, I am not advocating this song in any way. In fact, it's a really an instructive thing. One of the things that I realized is that, you know, there are contemporary songs that people like, that people know the words to, that people sing, that they hum, and they've never really thought about what it says. You know, I'll give you an example. There was a song when I was a kid called Afternoon Delight. It was about having a sexual encounter in the middle of the day. And elementary kids would sing this in front of their parents. And nobody realized what they were singing about. But yet it's all, you know, pounding into the brain there, okay? So this is that all is like in that category. This is not a redeeming thing, but it is an interesting insight. And it's kind of a weird song. It's kind of a ballad where the verses are narrated, spoken. And then there's a refrain. And in the first verse, this singer talks about how as a little girl, her house caught fire, and she and her dad stood and watched the house burn to the ground. And when it was over, she said, "Is that all there is to a fire?" And then her dad took her to the circus, and she described some of the things she saw at the circus, and the circus came to the end, and she said, "Is that all there is to a circus?" And then as a teenager, you know, she fell in love with some boy, and he ended up dumping her, and her conclusion was, is that all there is to love? And then the song gets kind of dark, and the narration goes along the lines like, well, if that's the way she feels, why didn't she just go out and kill herself? You know, well, here's the refrain that gets sung, which is the song that people remember, but it goes, I got to look at this now, make sure I say it right. Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friends, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball if that's all there is. And you know, it's kind of like, you know, but you can't imagine how much of our world thinks like that. You know, they look at things and this doesn't satisfy. Is that there's got to be something more, and they reach the point where they say, "What's the point? I'm just, you know, let's just go out and eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die." Now, Solomon's going to say something similar to that later on in Ecclesiastes, and we'll grapple with how that differs, you know, the world's view, whatever. But that is the world we live in. There's this thought that pleasure satisfies. And it doesn't. And people are left shaking their heads saying, is that all there is to this? There's got to be something more. There's got to be something I'm missing. If that's all there is, what should we do about it? Just you go end our lives? You know, what do you do when you have everything you thought you ever wanted and it still isn't enough? And the conclusion that Solomon, you know, has for us, you know, as we work our way through this book, is that, you know, our dissatisfaction with life ought to point us to God, not turn us away from Him. It ought not lead to, you know, just distress or whatever. It ought to help us realize that, you know, what we need is God. Our spiritual longings should give us a clue that we were made for the pleasures of God, you know, not for the pleasures of this world. And when we look to God, and when we realize that the fulfillment and meaning and satisfaction come only from Him and through Him, we will find Him to be enough. We won't have to say, is that all there is? Because He is enough. If we'll give Him time to show that to us. You know, we kind of think we want God to just kind of give us a happy pill or whatever, and, you know, and make life easier. That's not what it's about. It's about realizing that it's not those circumstances, it's not the pleasures of life that bring fulfillment. It's knowing the God who created you. It's knowing the Savior who redeemed you. It's knowing His purpose in your life. It's knowing that there is more than just life under this sun. There is so much more. Now, it doesn't mean that life under the sun is pointless, meaningless, wasted. It just means that that's not all there is. There is more. There is more that gives meaning, that gives substance, that brings satisfaction in life. And one of the things that you learn as you begin to walk more and more closely with God is that God has showered us with pleasures and riches and blessings, everything that we need, many of the things we want, things that we don't know we want but we really need. And He just brings those things into our lives. And the key to enjoying those pleasures is realizing that they are from God and that they can only be appreciated when they cause us to look past the things, the stuff, the enjoyments, and rather see behind them the God who gives them and the God who loves us. Last verse and then we'll be done. 1 Timothy 6:17. Paul says, "Charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded nor trust in uncertain riches." Don't think that the pleasures of riches are the answer. Don't think that they are going to satisfy. But instead, trust in the living God who gives richly all things to enjoy. You know, sometimes in our conservative Christian circles, you know, we tend to, in our more pious moments, look down on having fun, you know, look down on enjoying things about life. Now, enjoying things about life is not where ultimate satisfaction comes. But God has created us to have dominion over this world. He's created us to enjoy the life, the people, the relationships, the circumstances that he allows. And yes, sometimes he brings us through deep waters and suffering, you know, because he wants to remind us that it's not the circumstances, it's not the stuff of this earth that matters. It's a relationship with him. But along the way, he gives to us richly so many things. And enjoyed in the context of these are gifts from God. Really, life on this earth can be a very pleasurable thing. You know, I envision the, you know, early believers. They were serious-minded folks, but they had their times of laughter. They had their times of just relaxing and enjoying one another's company. They had those things. I think Jesus had times like that with his disciples. You know, but that wasn't what life was all about. Those were just incidental blessings that God gives along the way that we can enjoy. But we don't enjoy them for their own sake, per se. We just recognize that this, again, is a blessing of God, is a gift of God, is God pouring out upon us so that we will appreciate him and love him as the giver, independent of the gifts. Under God's hand, you know, we can be creative and build homes and gardens like Solomon did. We can compose music. We can find joy in sexual experience. All of those things that are pleasurable for us will be truly pleasurable if we view them as gifts from God and we understand and we use them for his glory, for his honor, within the parameters of his instruction. Solomon's point isn't, you know, don't have gardens, don't have flowers, don't have houses, don't, you know, have gatherings of people for banqueting, don't laugh. That's not his point. His point that is, if those things are the substance of life, they will not satisfy. If those things are just the incidental blessings of God along the way, if God takes them, if God gives them, that's up to God. We're trusting in him. Then suddenly we find great joy in many things that otherwise might be even frustrating. That's the lesson that Solomon learned from his pursuit of pleasure. And it's a lesson that we need to take away rather than going on our own empty, unsatisfying pursuit of pleasure in the things of this world. Father, we're thankful for your word. I pray that you would use this passage and these thoughts that we have considered tonight to help us just adjust our outlook, kind of calibrate our thinking a little bit. And might we keep our eyes on you. Yes, we were thankful for your blessings, for the things that you give us, for the people you give us, for the opportunities you give us. But ultimately, satisfaction, pleasure, joy, security in life, it just comes from knowing you and walking with you. I pray that you would help us to that end. Pray especially for young people, whether those here in the auditorium, those perhaps who are listening on the live stream, that they would in particular choose to learn from Solomon's quest rather than going on one of their own. We ask your blessing now as we spend some time together in prayer. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. Pastor Mike, if you'd come share some prayer requests.